This was supposed to be a quiet month for Congress, but as representatives and senators return from Thanksgiving break, problems are plentiful, and finding solutions will test leaders of both parties. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On this Politics Day, we ask our analysts, Stefan Schmidt and Tim Hagel, how party leaders are positioning themselves for the final 2 weeks of the lame duck Congress, and also ask about the bigger implications of the race-related events in Ferguson. Also, questions about why Iowa's Congressman-elect Rod Blum loaned a National Hockey League player $2 million in 2011. Join our discussion on this Politics Day. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Wednesday. That must mean it's Politics Day here on the program. Joining me in the studio, Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Hello, Tim.
Hey there.
And after a many-month absence, a big warm welcome to Stefan Schmidt, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hello, Stefan. Welcome back.
Hi, Ben. And hi, Tim.
And we want to talk about many things this hour. Two main things. We want to talk about what the lame duck Congress will be up to before the holiday break. A few other things thrown in as well. But also, we want to talk about the continued fallout over the situation in Ferguson. And we'd like to have your comments as well, River to River listeners. Monday, President Obama met with law enforcement officers, young activists and politicians, and he focused not on the case that the grand jury decided there, but more broadly on the tensions between police and those they're sworn to protect. He proposed a three-year, $263 million spending package to expand training, increase the use of body-worn cameras for monitoring police officers' interactions with us, the public. So listeners, we want to hear what you have to say about this. What do you think of the events in Ferguson, and what do they have to say about the state of race relations in our country? And what is the government's role at all levels in improving race relations? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook to leave your feedback. Stefan Schmidt, on Monday, an opinion piece appeared that you authored in the Des Moines Register. It reflected on the bigger political implications race-related events in Ferguson and across the nation have caused here. Give us some of the reflections you share in that article.
I think my main mission was to point out that race has been and continues to be an incredibly important piece of the American political culture, of the economy, and of American society, and that it goes through cycles when we sort of ignore it, when it seems as though we've overcome these problems, when we think we've passed civil rights legislation, and now people can vote as they wish and are not discriminated against anymore. And then we are suddenly caught off guard with essentially a wave of incidents in which race comes to the surface, and in which African Americans finally talk about how they still feel that they are basically picked on, that they are discriminated against, that policing often hits the African American community harder than other parts of the American society. And the result of this incident and of the protests and of all of the discussion has been a strange polarization. I thought my article was pretty balanced. I quoted African Americans about this issue, and I quoted Mayor Giuliani, former mayor of New York, on it. Different perspectives on who was at fault and whether justice was carried out. And even though I thought the article was balanced, I got hate mail from everybody. I got hate mail from people who said I was, you know, basically a racist, and I wasn't recognizing this. I got it from conservatives who said that I was, you know, soft and liberal and, you know, bending to the race baiting issue. And that just proved to me that this is a third rail in American politics in many ways.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. Let's play a little bit of something that he threw in here that really got tempers up. Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press, Rudolph Giuliani said that while he and other mayors of major cities have been trying to ensure peace between the black community and the police, the conversation regarding Ferguson has centered around some facts, but not others. Here's a snippet of that conversation.
But the fact is, I find it very disappointing that you're not discussing the fact that 93% of blacks in America are killed by other blacks. We're talking about the exception here.
Well, look,
this is about a distrust issue.
We are talking
about the significant exception. 93% of blacks are killed by
I'd like to see the attention paid to that
that you are paying to this.
Former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani this past weekend. Tim Hagel, let me turn to you and have your thoughts on the political implications in the wake of Ferguson and the grand jury decision.
Well, it's the question is, where do you start on something like this? Because it is one of these things, as Stefan was saying, where it seems to pervade American politics in a wide variety of ways. And I like his characterization, Stefan's characterization of it as being essentially a third rail, meaning something you just have to not touch. At least if you're certain politicians. You know, obviously some people do want to bring it up and want to highlight certain problems. Other people want to say, well, wait, okay, yes, those are problems, but there are other aspects to this as well. But it's often very difficult for politicians to talk about, particularly in any constructive way, because the sides do seem to be polarized, not unlike some other issues in American politics as well. But it does seem that it's a one that is difficult and rather persistent.
Mm-hmm. We have the first black president in office in his sixth year of office. When he was ushered in, some were ushering also in a post-racial political period. Stefan, do you think that you said this is a long history of race riots, race problems here? How has, in your view, President Obama handled this upsurge? The latest upsurge in racial tension?
Well, first of all, the first black president unfortunately did not represent the post-racial era in American politics. It's clear when you read the literature, when you look at networks and different cable stations and newspapers and magazines and think tanks that lined themselves up, what Obama did was he essentially was flammable liquid. And it set on fire a huge sort of backlash in which conservative groups and others just really didn't like him. He is too liberal, and his liberalness and his blackness created a terribly toxic environment. And I think that in fact, race relations went downhill in many respects after President Obama was elected. How he's handled it is... You can't win when you're a president and an issue like this comes up, because he's tried to walk a very fine line. African Americans and progressives and others feel that he has waffled on the issue of justice, that he didn't go to Ferguson and he didn't take a strong position on the issue of law enforcement versus African American teenagers and so on. Conservatives, of course, have accused him of the opposite and said that, you know, essentially he represents a view in the United States that law enforcement is out to kill African Americans, and he's basically, you know, sided with lawlessness. And so he's handled it, I think, the best that you can. But again, as Tim also mentioned, it's really in some respects a lose-lose proposition, because no matter what position you take, and especially a black president, no matter what position he takes, he's going to get clobbered from one side or the other. And in this particular case, from all sides.
Mm. Join our conversation. Tell us what you think the events in Ferguson have to say and the aftermath have to say about the state of race relations in our country. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Find us on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. Clayton joins us. Clayton from Cedar Rapids. Hello, welcome to our program. What do you have to chip in on this topic, Clayton?
Well, what I want to say is historically in this country, when white people went out and got black people, they did it as a mob. And now what that particular function has been transferred to the police department. I'm not saying all police are bad, so don't take off on it. So they are transferred. So that way, white people are able to vent a rage against black people through the institution, which the police department is one of them. And I'm going to say this, is as long as black people are perceived as being human beings masquerading as animals, we're never going to get past the problem. If you want to go to Officer Wilson's testimony, he describes him as looking like a demon. He describes him as a five-year-old holding Hulk Hogan. Both these men were basically the same size. Mike Brown was a little bit heavier than it. And then when he describes Mike Brown when running away from him, kicking up dust. Now, I've been on a Canfield court in Ferguson. I've actually been there at the memorial. There's no dust on that street. That's a concrete street. So what are we describing? Somebody that is superhuman.
Clayton, if I can break in here, too. We wanted to sort of stay around the specifics of the case looked at by the grand jury is one thing. We wanted to look at the political implications. Here, specifically, with your comments, I wanted to ask you, what do you think is the government's role in improving race relations?
The government's role in improving race relations.
What can the government do in this situation when something like Ferguson happens? Have you been inspired or disappointed in the leadership the president has shown?
I'm not disappointed. The president's in a tough spot. Damn if he does, damn if he doesn't. Now, they want him to go to Ferguson, and I don't really think he should go to Ferguson because I think there would be an assassination attempt taken on if he goes to Ferguson. So I think that'd be a bad idea if he went to Ferguson. And the whole thing is that we're going to have to realize is probably one of the things that could be done politically, that anytime there's an excess force charge or also killing an individual in a questionable manner in this country, it should become a federal crime and not a state or local crime thing. And I think that would be very unpopular, but those should become federal cases because the federal government tends to be a little bit more objective on how they look at cases.
Okay, Clayton, thank you for your view from Cedar Rapids, 1-866-780-9100. Tim Hagel, what, if any, political consequences does this have as we, in a few weeks' time, enter a political caucus campaign season for the 2016 president?
Well, as always, it's a little difficult to say. We've seen incidents like this that have sparked national attention in the past for a variety of reasons, and often nothing directly comes from it, at least nothing at a national level. We had the clip before of Rudolph Giuliani, and of course there was a time, and I can't remember the timing of this, I don't know if he was mayor at the time or not, but the New York City had a street cop unit that were very aggressive in looking to crimes. And at a certain point, they killed a gentleman by the name of, if I'm recalling correctly, Amadou Diallo. And they fired something like 40, 41 bullets. And he was hit something like 19 times, obviously died. And it turns out that what he was reaching for was not a gun, but was his wallet. And so, of course, that street unit was disbanded and so forth. And it became national news. And there were racial issues, of course, that were going on. But nothing perhaps really came of it in the long term. So you do see sometimes a reaction at the local level, which is often a good thing because of certain tensions that may exist, whether it's in New York or other cities, Ferguson in this particular case. But whether it does anything at a national level is hard to say. But you're right. We do have the caucuses coming up, and this may be something that will be of interest to people in talking about these kinds of things. Rand Paul in particular has talked about Republicans reaching out more to other communities that aren't normally associated with Republicans, whether it's blacks or Hispanics or you know, whatever. So we may see some discussion of this, but it's hard to say if anything tangible will come of it.
You have a view on that, Stephen Schmidt, how this may ripple into the 2016 race?
Unfortunately, I think rather than a discussion, which, Tim, would be terrific, what it's going to, I think, deteriorate into is going to be grandstanding, and I think Republicans are going to make a lot of hay out of the riots and the violence and pointing out that, you know, African-American youth commit a large percentage of crime in many cities. And this is and Democrats are going to have to take the opposite position. So I have a feeling it's going to sort of become a partisan, you know, fest of some sort rather than searching for solutions. And the real problem is that with a deteriorating economy, with the middle and working class slipping and the lower working class slipping even more in terms of wages and jobs, the African-American community is, you know, socially and economically a place of a lot of hurt. And out of that comes crime and gangs and drugs and guns and youth essentially committing crimes and being then arrested and the white community fleeing to the suburbs. You know, we've seen all of this before. So it's just a tremendously complicated issue, which I think would be resolved very quickly if economic development and growth were to suddenly break out in some of these most depressed communities in the country. Otherwise, we're back to, you know, police profiling. I mean, Mayor Giuliani and Mayor Bloomberg did a tremendous amount of racial profiling in New York City, targeting African-Americans and Hispanics as a way to bring law and order and reduce crime, in especially in Manhattan. And the white community, the Asian community, was very grateful for that. But on the other hand, it was at a very high price, which was that minorities were, in fact, targeted for stop and search.
Let's try to get a call or two quickly in before our break. Larry is with us in Waterloo. You've been listening, Larry. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a little perturbed. It seems like the, you know, over the last 6 years that Obama's been in office, a lot of conspiracy theorists on the right have, you know, talked about FEMA camps and they're going to round us all up. And they don't seem to be too bothered by the fact that the police are becoming more and more militarized. They're having more and more military equipment. And it strikes me that perhaps that's because they can't visualize themselves being the target, and it doesn't really bother them as long as it's somebody else getting the brunt of the problem. I think the thing in Ferguson brings up race, but it also points out that the tendency of officers to use lethal force when it's not necessary is as big a concern as the other, you know, the other things.
Mm-hmm. Larry, thank you for the comment from Waterloo, and I think that's I didn't dig into the details, but the president's proposed 3-year package was for the body-worn cameras for police officers. The other was to expand training in this area. And
Can I react to that?
Yeah,
just
please.
Very briefly, because it's very interesting. I have been talking on the phone and emailing, texting and so on with a lot of acquaintances. And the interesting thing is that non-African-American acquaintances of mine have said, look, I've had run-ins, unjustified run-ins with law enforcement, where I was treated as a criminal having done absolutely nothing. One of my friends actually took a police officer to court and won the case, so that we may actually be talking about a larger problem beyond white police officers and African-American communities about the way that law enforcement now perceives their role. Their role has become much harsher. I mean, you remember police officers used to patrol on foot. They used to walk down Main Street. They used to go into stores, say hi to people and, you know, talk to kids on the street and so on. Now they are driving usually one officer alone in a vehicle that is virtually like a combat jet airplane, only on wheels. Mm. It has every kind of weapon in it. It has
But we're saying in some communities, many of our listeners live in communities where we greet the police officers. They are our friends. They are our neighbors.
Yes. But even in places like Ames, Police officers sometimes are very aggressive. They have apparently been taught really not to smile at people, but to have a fairly stark and harsh demeanor as a way of maybe avoiding, you know, some sort of mixed signal. And so I think the law enforcement community itself, whether it's in black communities or large cities or smaller communities, maybe needs to reassess its function, how it performs, and so on. I understand why when you go into a police office or a sheriff's office, you can't walk in anymore and say, you know, is Paul Fitzgerald in, and walk over to his office and shake his hand. You are confined to a very small area now in most places, behind bulletproof glass where there is some receptionist. It is a highly armored and defensive environment anymore. And that's in part because police officers are worried about someone coming in and essentially causing harm, you know, somebody mm-hmm. coming in and wreaking havoc. But by that definition, if you've ever been to a police headquarters, or if you've ever been to the sheriff's office, you know, to get a gun permit or something, you don't feel like a citizen. You really feel almost on the edge of someone who ought to be booked for something, because you're confined.
Let me kind of take the other side of this a little bit. And you even started that by suggesting that there's a good reason for this. And I happen to participate in something we've got here in Johnson County called the Citizens Police Academy a couple of years ago, where they go through and they basically are, it's an attempt to reach out to citizens to explain, police to explain in a variety of ways, things that they do and the reasons. And one of the things that they showed us are instances where police officers maybe would pull somebody over for speeding or something like that, walk up on a person and get immediately shot, yep. and a variety of things like that. So there's a reason that they have often that they have to react that way. And the thing is, and unfortunately this is the reasoning behind it, is because they have to be always on guard, that affects what would normally be very relaxed type of situations. And for its funding cuts that they can't ride together in cars perhaps, and so that makes it more difficult for them as an individual to do their jobs.
We're coming up on a break. Tony has been waiting. He's driving a truck here in Iowa. Tony, quickly, what's on your mind in this regard?
Okay. Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
All right. Well, my comment is, you know, from day one, when President Obama took over, he was the enemy. I mean, not to all everybody, not to all Americans, but to quite a few. They said it. But they ain't trying to hide it from nobody. They go to make him a failure, period. His mother is white. His father was African. So he's both. You understand where I'm coming from?
Mm-hmm.
So in dealing with this Ferguson situation, he's caught between the rock and the hard place. If he defend the police, he wrong. He goes to the blacks, he wrong. You know, and I'm saying blacks because every time you look around, the narrative changed. I mean, I have ancestors that may have come from Africa, but I was born right here in America. I'm 43. I'll be 44 this year. So I'm black. When I fill an application out of here, African American on there, I check other and put black because that's what I am. I mean, some may get offended, but that's their right. That's their opinion. But me, myself, I'm black. I'm not going to constantly get changed and stereotyped for something I don't know nothing about, really. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, Tony,
you know,
we have to take a break. Thank you for your view. And safe driving in that truck.
Thanks.
All right. We're going to come back. Continue Politics Day here on River to River with Stephen Schmidt and Tim Hagel. When we come back, we'll talk about what's on the docket for the lame duck Congress. It was supposed to be a quiet month, but not so. We'll find out when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Diabetes affects some 30 million Americans, another 86 million of us. That's about a third of our population have pre-diabetes. Tomorrow on this program, we'll look at the latest research on risk factors, prevention, and those big unanswered questions that diabetes researchers are tackling. Tomorrow, the entire noon hour, diabetes, our focus. Today, politics Wednesday. And the first half hour, we talked a little bit about Ferguson, the political implications in the aftermath of the unrest in Ferguson. This half hour, I want to talk about the lame duck Congress and look forward to what will be happening in Washington. And I wanted to start off with this. Yesterday, incoming Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that he's, quote, perplexed by President Obama's actions since the midterm elections. Here he is speaking at a Wall Street Journal CEO Council event yesterday in Georgetown.
I don't have any fundamental problem with negotiating with the other side, and we don't have any personal problems. There is, however, a deep philosophical difference. I mean, if you look at the way the president's reacted to what could only be described as a butt-kicking election, by any objective standard, the president got crushed in this election. So I've been perplexed by the reaction since the election, a sort of in-your-face, dramatic move to the left. So I don't know what we can expect.
Incoming Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Tim Hagel, tell us now that we're in this curious transition period, how each party is looking at it. Mitch McConnell says he's perplexed by the president's actions. Give us some context.
Well, one of the things that struck me about this is we see a difference between President Obama's reaction and that of President Clinton when they had a Republican wave election in 1994. Of course, a big difference was that that happened in the second year of Clinton's presidency, and he had to look forward to at least the rest of his first term, and he had hoped, and it turned out to be the case for a second term as well. And he basically had the skills to be able to work and find ways to work with the Republican majorities in Congress. That hasn't been the case for President Obama. And, of course, you had a wave election in 2010 where the Republicans took control of the House, but the Democrats retained control of the Senate. And so it didn't force Obama to do the kinds of negotiating with Republicans that Clinton did. And plus, some would argue that Obama doesn't have those same negotiating skills, isn't really willing to reach out and have formed those relationships with the Republicans that Clinton did. And, of course, Clinton was criticized from the left for some of the things he did do with Republicans. So there's that aspect too. So it seems that at this point, this late stage, that President Obama maybe is not really going to be willing, or at least as willing, to work to a great extent with Republicans. He certainly is going to do certain things with them, but is not perhaps willing to what some would characterize as compromise his positions. Of course, how much he's willing to give in depends on how you characterize it in terms of whether it's a compromise or whether it's abandoning your principles and so forth. So he's going to get some criticism probably regardless of what he does.
Mm-hmm. So the moves we're talking about are that Mitch McConnell, some of them, the emissions pact with China, not involving the Congress. Of course, the executive action to shelter millions of undocumented immigrants from deportation, an executive order there. Stefan Schmidt, would you be perplexed in Mitch McConnell's shoes, or would you say that's in keeping with what we've had from past presidents who've had this kind of butt-kicking, as Mitch McConnell put it?
Well, first of all, Obama wasn't on the ballot. So to argue that the voters rejected Obama is sort of, you know, by second order, because what the voters rejected was a lot of Democrats who were running in states for the Senate or governorship or in districts where the voters simply rejected the Democrat. And in the South, the voters have been rejecting Democrats serially and consistently to the point where there are no more Democrats in the South, elected Democrats. They have been wiped out, and that has been long coming. I mean, that is a trend that precedes Obama by many decades. In some other instances, you could say that Democrats lost because they had candidates who weren't very effective, who didn't run very good campaigns, who seemed to be clueless about how to get elected. And I've made many friends with those defeated Democrats in Iowa by pointing that out. We had some races in Iowa, especially for the House, that were really poorly run. The candidates, you know, just didn't do the job. And that's a rejection of a candidate more than Obama. So, number two, Obama essentially hasn't reached out in part to the Republicans, because the Republicans' mission from the day that he was elected was to make him a one-term president, not to cooperate with him, to block as much as they could, to make problems for any kind of dialogue. And so when you're when Obama is faced with an adversary in the form of the Republicans, who are first of all very distant from him in terms of ideology and philosophy and policy, and secondly, who really want to see him paralyzed and defeated, I guess it would be discouraging if you were Obama to try to negotiate with folks who take such a hard line. The presidents have the prerogative of executive orders. They're signed all the time. President Bush created one of the largest marine preserves in the Pacific around Hawaii simply by signing an executive order that made this marine reserve. And so that's part of the president's power. We'll have to see whether Obama's signing this immigration executive order is unconstitutional or not. Steve King is certain of it. Unfortunately, Steve King is not sitting on the Supreme Court, which is the only authorized certified body in the United States that can declare a presidential action unconstitutional.
And evidently, as we heard in our news halfway through the program, Steve King's position is not the majority position within the GOP.
No, but it is certainly one very, very strong wing of the GOP, which can, if it chooses to, blow up the House. I mean, you know, the very conservative Tea Party wing of the Republican Party has a tremendous amount of passion and determination. And they can, you know, if they want to, they can make life pretty miserable for Speaker Boehner.
Okay, we have the new House. Let's pivot over there from the Senate. We heard from Mitch McConnell. When the new Congress takes its oath in January, Republicans could occupy as many as 247 seats. This is a 435-seat U.S. House. It gives them, according to my figures, their most dominant House majority in over 80 years. You're shaking your head, yes, Tim Hagel. Now, let's listen to John Boehner. You posed the problem there, Stefan. John Boehner yesterday, Republican House Speaker, said that when it comes to passing a measure to fund the government, now the due date there, December 11th, there have been no decisions made, but that members of Congress are working on it. Now, keeping in mind, here's his comments, keeping in mind that the president's executive action on immigration reform are on the minds of many in the GOP, in his party.
Now, this is a serious breach of our Constitution. It's a serious threat to our system of government. And frankly, we have limited options and limited abilities to deal with it directly. But that's why we're continuing to talk to our members. We've not made decisions about how we're going to proceed, but we are, in fact, going to proceed.
Okay. Tim Hagel, what do you hear in that statement? Of course, that's an excerpt from a longer statement. Boiling it down to perhaps that most in the GOP are happy to leave this immigration fight for another day when the new Congress is in?
Well, yes, particularly with the new Congress being in, because then, of course, the Republicans will have a majority in the Senate, so they'll be able to get some things done. And that's been one of the complaints, and it, depending on the issue on both sides, where Congress hasn't done certain things, hasn't been able to get bills passed. And that's one of the things about Harry Reid controlling the Senate for so long, is he's been able to keep things from getting passed and getting on the president's desk. So the president hasn't had to make a hard choice in terms of signing or vetoing a particular piece of legislation, and also hasn't had to, back to the previous issue, had to work with Republicans to fashion legislation that he would, in fact, be willing to sign. As far as the immigration issue, I think Boehner's right that there's a lot of talk. Some people are quite certain that it's unconstitutional. They may have a point. Other people look at it and say, no, it's not. It is constitutional. Stefan was mentioning that other presidents have used the executive order, but the counterargument to that, of course, is that it's a different in kind. It's different in scope, even to the extent that previous presidents have signed orders, executive orders, with respect to immigration itself. So we just kind of have to wait and see how it all shakes out at this point. I don't know that – we don't know for sure what the president's executive order is going to be, so we can't be too certain what the reaction to that's going to be as well.
Charlie Cook was on this program yesterday, one of the best-known political analysts in the country, founder and editor of the Cook Political Report. I wanted to play a short excerpt of what he says said about immigration. Charlie Cook from yesterday's program.
When you saw the number two Republican in the House, the majority leader Eric Cantor, lose his primary as much on immigration as anything else, that sort of sent shockwaves around the party that – You know, we used to talk about Social Security being the third rail of American politics, but at least in the Republican Party, immigration reform would seem to be that third rail. Touch it and you die.
Okay, many third rails in this program. Evidently, we had it in the first half hour. Stephan Schmidt, where do you see immigration reform going from here?
Well, I've written a bunch of op-ed pieces in which I argued that for it's a vocabulary issue. For Republicans, immigration reform really means hardening and militarizing the border and making sure that no more people cross the border. It does not include really normalizing the situation for the 11 million plus who are in this country undocumented illegally. For the Democrats, it's border security, but more than that, it's finding a way to incorporate the 11 million who are in the U.S. into the American economy and legal system. And that's a gap the size of the Grand Canyon. So they're not talking about the same thing at all. And I agree with Charlie Cook, and I've said it myself, that for Republicans, there is almost nothing to be gained from supporting immigration reform that includes amnesty or any kind of normalization. The Republicans have a base in very conservative districts, especially House districts and some states, in some states, the senators themselves have not very much to gain. The Latino vote in the United States, even though it's important for presidential elections, is largely irrelevant in most congressional races and marginally, in some places, marginally important in Senate races. So for the Republicans, what Obama is doing is very unpopular with the voters in their district, the majority of voters in their districts. And so they have nothing to gain from it.
Okay. So we heard Speaker Boehner talk a little bit about addressing immigration there. What is with his caucus, with his 47 GOP members in the House, what can they do about the action the president has already taken in regards to immigration? Tim Hagel.
Well, at least as far as what we've seen so far, Steve King and others have talked about defunding certain things and concerns along those lines. But and I guess the file a lawsuit basically is about it, because I think that you'll hear occasionally people talking about impeachment, although you often hear about that more from the left as sort of a scare tactic, saying, oh, there's Republicans who are going to try to do this again. And very few Republicans are seriously talking about that, because they realize that they'd failed miserably in that regard. And when President Clinton was impeached, because the backlash was on the Republicans, so they don't want to go there again, just like they don't want to go there again with respect to shutting down the government, because they tend to lose the PR battle on that sort of thing. So I think at this point, one of the things that they're going to do is perhaps file a lawsuit and see what comes of that, see if in fact some of these actions are unconstitutional. As Steve King was mentioning, they have the power of the purse, so they can certainly defund certain things, but they have to be careful there, because if they go too far, then it's a shutting down of the government. And they're going to tend to lose that battle as well. So in some sense, the options is, and this sort of was what Boehner was talking about, that or at least realizing, if not stating explicitly, is that to some extent their options are somewhat limited until they have a Republican president in place.
Let's go to a couple of news items in politics that I want to get to before our hour ends up. We have this surface every once in a while. Don't criticize the First Daughters. This is a Republican congressional aide, Elizabeth Loudon, facing a backlash after sharply criticizing the First Daughters. She resigned over the weekend. A Facebook post that she put out surfaced after the White House's annual turkey pardoning ceremony. The post read, let's see if I can get to a little bit of it. Dear Sasha and Malia, I get you're both in those awful teen years, but you're part of the first family. Try showing a little class. At least respect the part you play. Then again, your mother and father don't respect their positions very much, or the nation for that matter, so I'm guessing you're coming up a little short in the good old role model department. The Facebook post continued. Nevertheless, stretch yourself, rise to the occasion, act like being in the White House matters to you, dress like you deserve respect, not at a spot bar, and certainly don't make faces during televised public events. Stephan Schmidt, traditional to keep hands off the president's children, any president's children.
Well, yeah, and the only thing she forgot to say is, you're black. You don't even look like the children of a president. You know, that would have been sort of the icing on this.
Well, come on, Stefan. You don't need to inject race in that kind of thing. That had nothing to do with it.
That has come up so many times when people are interviewed and they say, well, I, Mr. Obama and Mrs. Obama, they just don't look like a first family. You know, that has come up periodically all the time. And the Republicans want to beat up on everybody, I guess, who is in the White House, including the daughters.
And how many times did the Bush daughters get criticized?
Sometimes legitimately
when they were doing the underage drinking.
Yeah,
but the problem here has more to do with an emphasis. Well, I shouldn't say the problem is more to do with, because certainly this Republican operative shouldn't have been criticizing the president's daughters, at least not any more than other outlets were criticizing them for rolling their eyes and so forth. But on the other hand, it's not like other president's daughters, Republican and Democrat, haven't come in for a certain amount of criticism, unfair though it was.
Yes, and the people who did the criticism usually either resigned or were severely taken to task as doing something inappropriate. I mean, it's just not classy to take on the children of politicians or children in general. Leave them alone. You know, I mean, we've got some huge problems in this country. We don't need to poison the well even more with stuff like this. And you notice that. It created a fairly swift action there. It's just not appropriate. We ought to cut it out and concentrate on issues, concentrate on policy, concentrate on the collapse of the American infrastructure, which I think Obama mentioned today. I mean, if you fly around the world, the worst airports in the world are in the United States. People who come from other countries and land at Kennedy Airport just absolutely cannot believe. They think they've landed in some third world country, and we haven't done anything about that. We haven't done much about cybersecurity. We haven't done much about trying to generate more jobs and create recreate a robust middle class. So these kinds of issues are just big distractions, you know, and they get us to talking about something that we shouldn't be talking about because it's sort of trivial and irrelevant. We should be talking about the big issues.
Well, what I wanted to bring up, you may classify as that, but I did want to bring it up, get your comment about this. As at local politics, the Des Moines Register reporting this week that the U.S. Representative-elect Rod Blum in the 1st District loaned a National Hockey League player in 2011 $2 million presented as an investment opportunity for Blum, a financial bridge for this player. So a couple things jump out at you when you hear this, Tim Hagel. Who's got $2 million to lend, and why do you lend it to a National Hockey League player? Have you figured this out?
You know,
Blum will not make a comment.
I can understand why certainly Blum is a representative-elect doesn't want to really get into the fray of this and the details of personal finances and so forth. You know, it sounded like from the information that I've seen that it was one of these things where you have an intermediary that happens to know the player that needs the money, and he knows somebody who can lend the money and kind of brings these two people together, and they make an agreement. It didn't sound like anything that was untoward in any particular way, although the transaction went south in the sense that the player's family apparently was overextending him based on the potential earning for this $30 million contract that he had, and then the player ends up going in bankruptcy, and so now it's news. You know, if the player hadn't had all these other problems, the loan would have been paid off. We'd never worry about it.
Mm-hmm. Stefan, we've got a minute or so left. Did you see this?
I did, and I'm partly Republican. So my comment would be people are allowed to do with their money whatever the heck they want to do with it. And if they want to invest in a hockey player, hey, you know, that's their business. If they think that they're going to get a return on their investment, I don't care. As long as it doesn't involve anything particularly illegal. I think it was just a bad investment. It's like buying stock in Solyndra or something like that, in which case you just say, just put the money in the wrong place. But it is sort of odd to invest, you know, in an individual. But I guess people make loans all the time with a promise of a certain return on that investment. I'm surprised it didn't come up during the actual campaign.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a few seconds, a closeout question we like to go out with Tim Hagel over the next week or so. What will you be having your eyes on?
Well, we're starting to see the caucus season heat up. No surprise there. More of the candidates seem to be making decisions one way or the other. Rob Portman said he's out. Rand Paul seems to be looking for ways to make sure that he can run for both his Senate seat and the presidency. So more is coming.
Stephen Schmidt, 30 seconds for you as you look forward.
I want to see if the Iranians actually are able to be a good ally in crushing part of ISIS in part of that horrible conflict.
Mm. Okay. Okay. Part of a more of an international hour. We'll look forward to having you both back on the program. Stephen Schmidt, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Thank you for both of you for coming into our studio today, Tim and Stephen.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. We had help today in Ames from Garrett Van Leeuwen. Also, Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. Tomorrow on this program, as I mentioned, diabetes. It affects 30 million Americans. Another 86 million Americans, that's about a third of our population, have pre-diabetes. If this affects you or a loved one, you want to tune in tomorrow, perhaps join our conversation with a phone call or a question. Tomorrow, diabetes is the topic over the noon hour. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.